does the dirty work in our society, and who benefits?
I don't think we can understand dirty work without talking about power, without talking about class, without talking about race, because these jobs are not randomly distributed. They are delegated to the least powerful folks in our society.
That's Isle Press. We talk with him about his new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Then, in the U.S., more than 23,000 animals, not including fish, are slaughtered for our food every minute.
In just one day, more farmed animals are slaughtered than the total number of people killed in all wars throughout history.
That's Melanie Joy. We talk with her about the 10th anniversary of her groundbreaking book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The last time we spoke with Isle Press, it was about his book, Beautiful Souls. That was about people who take great risks to oppose unjust orders. Now he's back with a book about those who do the dirty work that society considers essential but morally compromised. In Dirty Work, he examines the drone pilots who carry out targeted assassinations, the undocumented immigrants who man the kill floors of industrial slaughterhouses, the guards who patrol the wards of America's most violent and abusive prisons, and more. But who benefits from this dirty work? And why is it mostly invisible? Press lifts the veil that keeps us shielded from an array of morally questionable activities that other, less privileged people perform in our name. Isle Press, welcome back to Writer's Voice. We last spoke with you about Beautiful Souls, your last book, which was about people who put a higher good above their own personal safety, rescuers, for example, in World War II and others. This is almost like the opposite. I mean, it's more than that, but talk a little bit about why you turned your attention to the dirty workers of society, the people who do the dirty work for society.
Well, you're absolutely right. There is a kind of united theme. In Beautiful Souls, my last book, I wrote about people who arrive at these really difficult moments where they're principles and values are at stake, and they keep their hands clean. They do the right thing with great risk, at great risk, and often personal cost. And as I was writing that book, I kept meeting people in the different contexts I was writing about who didn't manage to do that, who actually went along with, you know, unjust orders, or who were in situations where they did dirty their hands in some ways. And I got interested in their stories because I think that that's probably most of us. You know, moral courage is rare. It's hard to stand by one's principles when you're under constraints and pressures. And I started thinking a lot more about those constraints and pressures. And Dirty Work isn't just a book about people who do compromising things and go along and dirty their hands. It's also about the social conditions that create those situations. So it's really not just about individuals. It's about our collective values and our collective decisions.
And you define dirty work in two ways. On the one hand, essential workers, some of whom you talk about in the book, but also those who do jobs that many people see as morally compromised. Let's start with the second, since I think that's really the most central to the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right that, you know, when most people hear the phrase dirty work, I think they probably think of like a physically dirtying job, like hauling the garbage off the street. But I'm using it much more to talk about activities that are seen as morally fraught, morally compromised, but crucially, that society depends on in some way or tacitly condones. You know, when we think about, and this is an example in the book, of course, the dirty work of running and operating America's jails and prisons, where violence and abuse is unfortunately rife and is, by the way, the world's largest prison system. Well, there are people working in that system. There are people whose daily jobs involve helping operate that system. Or the dirty work of working on the kill floors of America's industrial slaughterhouses, which, of course, play a crucial role in the American lifestyle and in the American diet. And so in all of these cases, on the one hand, you have work that sort of makes people morally uncomfortable in some way. And then on the other hand, is very much related to big decisions we've made in our society, political decisions in the case of the prison system, consumer decisions and lifestyle decisions in the case of, you know, eating so much meat.
You also define it as work that causes substantial harm either to people or to non-human animals and the environment. And, you know, this was a tension that I felt in the book. I mean, of course, we are all complicit, yet some are more complicit than others. This is, you know, in the animal farm of our society, there are those who make the rules and who make it very difficult for others to step outside of those rules. Okay, maybe people can decide not to eat meat, but it's much more difficult for people to decide, for example, how their tax dollars are going to be used, if they're going to be used for drone operators. I mean, I think we've seen pretty well that most people don't have the power, not even through voting, to change that kind of policy. So I wonder if you could talk about the different levels of complicity.
Sure. Yeah. And I should say, the book very much does make the case that when we think about this dirty work, I think too often our impulse is to pin the blame on the frontline workers doing it, the low-level guards in prisons, the line workers in an industrial slaughterhouse. But my contention is that these workers are agents of society, that the conditions they work under and what they do and how they do it is shaped by much larger forces. Now, you're very right to say, well, wait a minute. Are we all really responsible for those things, or are some more responsible than others? And there's no question that there are gradations. I mean, the book opens with a very graphic story of abuses that take place in a prison in Florida. And as I note in the story and in one of the chapters, you know, there weren't just people tolerating this in Florida. There were actually companies profiting from it, because this was a mental health ward of a prison where severe abuses were taking place. And yet that mental health ward was run by two private companies, actually, Wexford and Corizon. And they were making money off of this. So, of course, we would say, well, they bear more responsibility than, you know, the person on the street who opens the newspaper and reads one day that terrible things were going on there, as indeed happened eventually when some of the abuses were reported on by the Miami Herald, including starving prisoners and locking them in a scalding shower. Now, the average person who reads that, you know, they're not as complicit as the private company making the money. And they may genuinely be horrified by this. And at that point say, you know, well, I don't want this done in my name. I don't approve of this. But here's where it gets more complicated. What about the before? What about right now, when we're not actually seeing a scandal make the news, but we do know that jails and prisons have become the largest mental health institutions in our society, the largest, you know, larger than hospitals, larger than community centers. And that development happened over decades, over years. And it was, I believe, shaped, if not by conscious choices that citizens made, certainly by a large degree of apathy and turning away, that eventually there became a kind of a sense of moral exhaustion. You know, we deinstitutionalized, we closed down these abusive asylums that weren't treating people well. But then a lot of people kind of forgot about it. And what ended up happening is jails and prisons stepped in, essentially, to do the dirty work of warehousing the mentally ill, particularly in poor communities. And too many, I think, have kind of kept it out of sight, out of mind. And that very much is the nature of dirty work as I describe it. It is in the shadows. It is not front and center in our consciousness. And to that extent, it does implicate more than just, you know, say the lone profiteering private company that's involved. It involves all of us.
In fact, you say, and I found this to be a really interesting point, that civilization equals concealment. And what it's concealing are the true power dynamics. You know, so, I mean, we can definitely call out citizens, but even there, the power dynamics, and I think you make it pretty clear in the book, there are, you know, the masters of war, there are the prison industrial complex, those are the people who are calling the shots. Talk more about this idea of civilization. I mean, are you also saying that civilization in some way means alienation from what is real, what is really going on?
That's a really interesting question. It definitely is a central theme of my book is, and I don't originate this idea, but I draw on a book called The Civilizing Process. And it's this really interesting study of manners and how they developed. But there's an idea in it that's related to things like prisons and industrial slaughterhouses, even though there's no mention of this in the book. The idea is that as we become more civilized, disturbing events are pushed into the private, are privatized and pushed behind the scenes of social life. This is what the author of that book, Norbert Elias, posited, that it's not that it goes away. It's that, you know, we don't want to see it. And keep in mind, he was talking about things like sneezing and, you know, going to the bathroom and carving animals at table, which used to be done in front of everyone and then became something that was done behind the doors of the butcher shop or the restaurant. But the idea has been picked up, and I pick it up and develop it in this book, that what happens as we become more and more, maybe we should put it in air quotes, civilized and advanced, is that these disturbing things are concealed from view, that we cloak them. And if think about drone strikes, right? It's not just that the whole program is so secretive. We never see the footage. You know, we have delegated this task of carrying out these targeted assassinations in a geographically unlimited area of the world to the military. But I don't recall a democratic debate, a presidential debate, where one of the candidates said, you know, the public should see what happens when these strikes hit. We should have some sense of what's happening. It's totally concealed from us. Likewise with slaughterhouses. Here we are. We have all these fast food restaurants. You know, you can get your meat and poultry cheap, quick, easy, in whatever, you know, palatable form the consumer wants it. But try getting a camera or a tape recorder into the place where that is processed. As I discovered in this book, it's actually harder to get into a slaughterhouse than it is to a military base or a prison, where I was at least allowed to come in and look around a bit. I wasn't allowed to go into the slaughterhouse I wrote about, which was a poultry plant in Texas. And that tells us something. What it tells us, I think, is that, you know, it's convenient for both the companies profiting, but also maybe for the consumers to have a degree of distance, and that distance is not just geographic distance; it's moral distance, and it takes place by, you know, closing off, you know, what we see.
And this moral distance also results in something you reference. In fact, you mentioned one of my favorite books. In fact, a book that had a huge influence in my life. I read it in the 1970s. It's called The Hidden Injuries of Class. I was absolutely delighted to see it, you know, talked about in your book, IL Press, in Dirty Work. Talk about what the hidden injuries of class are of the prison guards, the drone operators, the slaughterhouse workers.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's so central to the book. And that is a great book, The Hidden Injuries of Class. And it's such an evocative phrase. And what I think it means, and what is stated in the book, is that we know about low wages and, you know, material deprivation. And we think about these things when we think of inequality and class. But what we don't think enough about are the moral burdens and emotional hardships that different classes in society bear. And Dirty Work is really about that, because what I'm showing in case after case in the book is that these workers aren't just paid poorly, though many of them are. They also suffer things like stigma and shame and a feeling of degradation, a feeling of corroded dignity through doing a job where they feel devalued. And in some cases, they feel they are asked to do things that go against their own core values and beliefs. So in some cases, what they experience is called moral injury, a term that I use throughout the book. And it's a very important concept, because it's about what happens to someone whose job requires them to essentially violate their own sense of integrity. And those things are really important, but they're also really hidden. To go back to the hidden injuries of class, we don't have economists who can provide us with charts of those things. The only way we can learn about them is through stories. And that's why in this book, I chose to tell the stories of these workers and really to go into their lives in a very intimate way, because these injuries are so pernicious and debilitating. They are no less pernicious and debilitating, I think, than injuries of material, you know, need and poverty.
So tell us one of those stories. Talk about the case of Darren Rainey in Florida, the nurse who attended him, and also the CO that told you your morals changed, the corrections officer who told you that your morals change, that it's a slide when you take on that work.
So Darren Rainey was incarcerated at the Dade Correctional Institution. He was arrested on a drug possession charge. He had been arrested before. He had a history of mental illness. This is sadly a very familiar story in our country. He was, from what I know, from a quite poor Black neighborhood in Tampa, where there were no services for people like him. And so he ends up in the prison system, kind of cycling through. And instead of treatment, what happens is he winds up at the Dade Correctional Institution and he gets abuse. And the abuse comes in the form of what was known at the prison as the shower treatment. And this was basically locking men like Darren inside a shower where they couldn't turn off the water, and the temperature of the water was scalding. And Darren Rainey dies from this. His body is taken on a gurney out one night. And the following day, a woman named Harriet Kriskovsky comes to work. She's a mental health aide at Dade. And she hears that Rainey, she hears vaguely that Rainey fell and died. And at first she thinks, well, he must have slipped or had a heart attack. And the nurses tell her, no. This was abuse. This was deliberate. And she is horrified by this, really just aghast, as I think any sentient person would be. But she's also reluctant to report it. And the reason she's reluctant is that she fears the guards at the prison will retaliate against her. And keep in mind, she's a woman working at an all-male prison. And her own safety, her own security, is dependent on the goodwill of the security officers there. And she has learned this because when she earlier, before this all happened, challenged some things that the guards did. They started leaving her alone in the rec yard with, you know, dozens of inmates. And one day, actually, she was nearly assaulted when she was left alone. And this was the way the guards had of sending the mental health staff and the nurses the message, you know, you do what we say. Don't defy us. And Harriet has learned this lesson. And so she doesn't report what happens to Darren Rainey. But what she suffers is what we've just talked about, hidden injuries. She falls into a depression. Her appetite goes away. She actually starts losing her hair, which at first she thinks is just from stress. And later, by the time I've met her, she's come to understand that it was part of her trauma, her emotional wound from feeling complicit in all of this. And on one level, you know, anyone who reads her story and thinks about what happened at Dade is going to say, well, wait a minute, she was complicit. All of the mental health staffers who didn't report this were complicit. And that's true. On the other hand, how differently would any of us have acted in that situation? And where does the real responsibility lie? And this gets to the corrections officer you mentioned, who I interviewed, a guy named Bill Curtis. And, you know, Curtis told me that he had worked as a guard. He didn't deny that terrible abuse happened in the Florida prison system. In fact, he shared his diary with me, and he referred to some of the guards, his fellow officers, as serial bullies, people who just bullied and abused incarcerated people in a way that was just really, really disturbing to him. But he then went on to say, you know, before you limit the blame to those guards, he told me, think about what the citizens of Florida get. And what he concluded is they get what they pay for. The state had the third largest prison system in the entire country. And it spent the second least of all states on mental health services. And as I describe in the book, there is no secret to the politicians in Florida that what the prison and jail system, what the citizens of Florida pay for is an overcrowded, understaffed, violent system that ends up also serving as the state's de facto system of mental health asylums. And, you know, Curtis and the other guards weren't trained in how to deal with people with severe mental illnesses. So what do you expect to happen in such a situation? And as he said, you know, when you're a guard working in an understaffed facility and there's a lot of violence, you learn very quickly that the way to enforce order is through brutality and threats and fear. And surprise, surprise, you get a culture of abuse that comes out of that. And so I say all of that not to absolve in any way the guards who were responsible for the death of Darren Rainey and for other abuses that I write about in the book, but to pull back and look at other actors, you know, people like Rick Scott, who was then the governor of Florida in charge of the Department of Corrections. He didn't pay a price for these abuses. He is now a senator from Florida with a flourishing political career and a lot of power. So, you know, we have to think about who we delegate the dirty work to and who ends up getting blamed for it.
Yeah, you point out, you know, many of these jobs are jobs of last resort. They're for people who really often don't have other employment opportunities. And you contrast the silence that, you know, even those workers of conscience have about the abuse that happens to Jack Paulson, I believe his name is. He was a Google engineer. There was a Google project for China that would automatically identify websites that were barred by the censors and also refused to return results for searches on things like human rights or democracy. Jack Paulson had a voice, and he also, when his voice ultimately went nowhere in making a change, he left. So, you know, the point that you make is that feeling the stigma of these jobs and the power to fight against the abuse really depends on the degree of power that one has.
That's right. I don't think we can understand dirty work without talking about power, without talking about class, without talking about race, because these jobs are not randomly distributed. They are delegated to the least powerful folks in our society. And lo and behold, the elites and the people with power are free to distance themselves. And so, you know, this is not in any way, I mean, you mentioned the story of Jack Paulson, and I included that story because here is a person with a very clear, strong sense of moral principle. He was a Google employee, a very principled guy, wanted to do the right thing and ends up doing the right thing, which is, you know, he quits Google because he's not satisfied that they are, you know, this company they claim to be doing good in the world, making the world a better place. He concludes, you know, if you really believe that, you wouldn't do these kinds of projects. But he has a luxury that Harriet, the mental health aide I mentioned, didn't have. She stayed at her job because she couldn't get another one. You know, she had very bleak, limited opportunities. People in, you know, software engineers at places like Google have a lot more power in our society and a lot more flexibility. They have skills. You know, Jack Paulson had skills that enabled him to land on his feet and do other things. It's not that he didn't miss his paycheck. He certainly did. He told me as much. But he had a cushion, and he had some security, and Harriet had none. And the slaughterhouse workers I wrote about, who many of whom were undocumented immigrants, they had no cushion. They had very little voice. They had very few choices, certainly no good choices. And so dirty work is, I think understanding dirty work can help us understand what I call moral inequality. You know, who gets to sleep well at night and who ends up feeling sullied and degraded and, you know, in a sense, dirtied.
And so finally, you know, the responsibility lies with us all, maybe to differing degrees, but to some degree. You reference in the book that, you know, people are becoming more callous, less interested in solidarity. And yet there, you know, there is a movement afoot, and we saw that with Black Lives Matter, that really talked about solidarity, a solidarity economy, a solidarity society. I mean, it seems to me that that's a choice. What are some of your thoughts after having written this book about how you and others can help to make a change in this, create more justice, more equality?
Yeah, well, I what I concluded is that just as the responsibility for dirty work is shared, I think the answers, the change that can come has to be shared. It has to be collective. There's only so much that one individual deciding not to eat meat can do. But if that becomes a movement, if that becomes a movement not only to say, you know, we will only purchase these products if the animals are humanely raised, but also if the workers are humanely treated, which is something we don't often see on those, never actually see on those labels. You know, if people act collectively, a lot can change. And dirty work is not set in stone. In fact, you know, we've talked about prisons a lot in this conversation. We've had a sea change in this country in terms of popular awareness and, I would say, great moral discomfort with the fact that mass incarceration happened and that we have jailed and imprisoned more people than any society on earth. And that's, you know, a really, really important shift. But there's still a long way to go because there are still 2 million people, you know, who are caged and incarcerated in this country, often in invisible conditions. There's growing awareness of the problems with the industrial food system, but there's also a lot that remains hidden. So the book I've written is a provocation. I hope it raises awareness, and I hope it gets people thinking, and I hope it gets all of us thinking in more nuanced ways about the people who end up doing this dirty work, because they're not so separate from, you know, the rest of us. And just pinning the blame on them is really too easy.
A cop out, in fact. Well, I really think your work, your book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America, AL Press, is really a new way of looking at this that is so important. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
AL Press is an author and journalist who writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. In addition to Dirty Work, he's the author of Absolute Convictions and Beautiful Souls. Dirty Work was named one of the 10 best books of 2021 by Publishers Weekly. Next up, we talk about carnism. Find out why after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. When Melanie Joy first published her book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, in 2019, there were far fewer vegans than today. But still, the unbridled slaughter of billions of animals under conditions of the utmost cruelty still goes on every year in the U.S. alone. It's slaughter that's kept hidden from us, Joy argues, because if people could see it, they would abandon carnism in droves. In the following conversation, she tells us about the huge cost, not only to animals, but to the environment, to meat industry workers, and to consumers under the industrialized holocaust that is the meat industry. Melanie Joy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows is, it was first published just over a decade ago, back in 2010. Why did you decide to release a new edition at this time?
Well, you know, when I wrote my book back in 2010, it really emerged out of my own personal experience. I felt that I really wanted to raise awareness of a critical social issue. And I didn't want to write just another book about why people shouldn't eat animals. I wanted to write about why we do eat animals in the first place. And since 2010, when the book first came out, a lot has changed. Awareness of the catastrophic consequences of animal agriculture has really increased significantly. We know, for example, the extent, or many people, I should say, are aware of the fact that there's a tremendous amount of animal suffering involved. In fact, in just one day, more farmed animals are slaughtered than the total number of people killed in all wars throughout history. And the UN has pointed out that animal agriculture is one of the most significant contributors to some of the most serious environmental problems facing the world today, not the least of which is climate change. There's also a growing body of literature demonstrating the dangers of an animal-based diet and the benefits of a plant-based one. And then on top of this, we know that animal agriculture, specifically factory farms and wet markets, are a leading driver of pandemics and threats to public health. So awareness of the consequences of animal agriculture has really grown significantly in the past decade. And at the same time, awareness of veganism has grown, as has the availability and acceptability of plant-based or vegan foods. So the combination of more awareness and easier access to plant-based options has led many people to feel more morally uncomfortable at the notion of eating animals.
Yeah, and talking about morally, you delve into the psychology of what you call carnism, which is like sexism and racism. I'll ask you a little bit later to define it more clearly. But first, you start the book with a meal. It's a bit of a shocker. Tell us about that meal and why you began the book that way.
Well, you know, we could just do this thought experiment, right? Just imagine that you are at a dinner party and your host serves you a delicious beef stew. And so you ask your host for the recipe, and she replies that the secret is in the meat, that you need to start out with well-seasoned golden retriever. Now, chances are your experience of that meat dramatically changed, even though nothing about the meat itself actually changed. Chances are what you had just thought of as food, you now think of as a dead animal. And so what you just felt was delicious, you now feel is disgusting. And therefore, rather than continue to eat the meat, you probably want to throw it in the trash and maybe even take to the streets in protest. Our perceptions drive our feelings, which then drive our behaviors, which reinforce our perceptions. And when it comes to those animals who we have learned to classify as edible, our perceptions have become distorted. And so we end up disconnecting from our authentic feelings and acting in ways, engaging in behaviors that are really counter to what we would otherwise choose to engage in.
You say that carnism depends on invisibility. So now define carnism and talk about this invisibility problem.
Carnism is the invisible belief system or ideology that conditions us to eat certain animals. It's essentially the opposite of veganism. We tend to assume that only vegans and vegetarians follow a belief system. But the only reason we might eat pigs but not dogs, for example, is because we do follow a belief system when it comes to eating animals. When eating animals is not a necessity for survival, which is true for many people in the world today, then it's a choice, and choices always stem from beliefs. But most people who support carnism, who eat animals, don't even realize that they have a choice when it comes to eating animals. And this is in large part because carnism has remained invisible. We don't recognize the belief system that conditions us to distort our perceptions when it comes to the meat, eggs, or dairy of those animals we've learned to classify as edible. And we also don't see the animals who become the meat, eggs, and dairy that we consume. Carnism relies to a large degree on maintaining invisibility in order to ensure that people continue to support it when supporting carnism really runs counter to their own interests and the interests of others and to their core moral values of caring and compassion or fairness and justice.
You know, when you talk about invisibility, I mean, you could say that there is, you know, the animal industrial complex, certainly, and its lobby. Talk about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which basically outlawed the visibility of these industrial meat production facilities.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a law that has made it virtually impossible to document what is actually going on in so-called animal enterprises, in, you know, what we're talking about here, which is carnistic or animal agribusiness institutions. So any act that interferes with an animal enterprise is very often considered illegal. And this is why it's so hard, even for investigative journalists, to be able to get inside slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants to actually document what's going on.
Wasn't Oprah Winfrey sued under this act?
Oprah Winfrey was sued under another law, the meat libel laws. Oprah Winfrey had a number of years ago, I think it was a couple of decades ago now, made a statement on television referring to mad cow disease, saying that she wouldn't eat hamburgers again or she wouldn't eat beef again. And then she ended up sued for making that statement. And that sent a strong message to members of the public who became increasingly, you know, even those who would be documenting the problems inherent in carnism.
And you know, you said something just before this that I noted. You said that many people don't, eating meat is not a necessity for many people. Are you implying that for some people it is a necessity?
Well, for people who are economically disadvantaged, they're not in a position to make their food choices freely. So I am saying it is a necessity for some people, for people who do not have the opportunity to choose what they eat. Many people in the world today do have the ability to choose what they eat. And those are the people I'm speaking to when I'm talking about really working to transform carnism.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Melanie Joy about her book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, An Introduction to Carnism. Part of the invisibility of animals is the invisibility to their own feelings, thoughts, lives as living, thinking, and experiencing creatures. I wonder if you could talk about cows and pigs as social animals, talk about hens, talk about fish.
Well, I think most people today do accept the reality that other animals are in fact sentient. You know, they bleed like we do. They scream out when they're in pain. They have, you know, similar structures to us in many ways. Most people recognize that non-human animals, like human animals, have the capacity to feel pleasure and pain and have lives that matter to them. It's harder for people, I think, to make that connection when it comes to aquatic animals such as fish and certain crustaceans, but more and more literature today has demonstrated the sentience and, in fact, intelligence of these individuals as well, such that in some places in the world, it's illegal to harm them in certain ways. So, for example, Whole Foods has banned the selling of live lobsters and crabs on the grounds that doing so, so that they end up boiled alive, essentially, is inhumane. There has been a tremendous amount of documentation on the intelligence and consciousness of different species. For example, pigs are known to be as intelligent as three-year-old humans. Some people keep pigs as pets. Chickens, you know, we often refer to, or we have in the past referred to people as quote unquote bird brains and used chickens as an example of stupidity, when in fact chickens are also intelligent. They're also sentient. People do also keep chickens as companion animals. Chickens can learn their names. Chickens can bond with humans and with each others. I could go on and on about this, but suffice it to say that the animals who become our food are not, they're not machines. They're living sentient beings that most people, the vast majority of people, would be deeply, deeply disturbed by witnessing the suffering of these individuals. And in fact, most people, when exposed to images of animal suffering, want to turn away because we are hardwired to feel empathy for others. And that includes other animals. Most people genuinely care about the well-being of other animals and would never willingly contribute to harm toward them, especially when that harm is so extensive and intensive and so completely unnecessary. And yet most people eat animals multiple times a day and support and, you know, in so doing, contribute to what is arguably the most exploitive industry of animals in human history. And this is because of carnism, because we have been so deeply conditioned to disconnect from our authentic thoughts and feelings when it comes to those animals that we've classified as edible.
Chickens can learn their names?
Some chickens can come when you call and can respond to calling their name. Chickens can, you know, there's actually some interesting websites for people who raise chickens and live with chickens. It's there are farm sanctuaries around the world where you can actually go and visit rescued farmed animals of all different species. So, you know, what I think is most important for, you know, people who are joining this program or listening to this program is to really recognize that when we are born into this system, carnism is what's called a dominant system. And when you're born into a dominant system, you inevitably internalize that system. In other words, we learn to look at the world through the lens of carnism. Carnism is so widespread that its tenets, its teachings are invisible. They're woven through the very structure of society to shape norms, laws, behaviors, you know, et cetera. And they become institutionalized. They're embraced and maintained by all major social institutions. So when we study nutrition, for example, we also study carnistic nutrition. And because carnism is a violent system, you know, it really runs counter to what most people would be willing to support. It needs to use a set of psychological defense mechanisms that distort our perceptions and disconnect us from our natural empathy for farmed animals so that we support harm to them without fully realizing what they're doing, what we're doing. And I can give you a couple of examples of these carnistic defenses, if you like, for listeners who might be wondering what I'm talking about.
Yes, please do.
So one way that carnism influences our perceptions is by conditioning us to think of farmed animals as abstractions, as lacking in any individuality or personality of their own. So we learn to believe, for example, that a pig is a pig and all pigs are the same. Carnism also teaches us to think of farmed animals as objects. So we refer to the chicken on our plate, for example, as something rather than someone. These are essentially distancing mechanisms. They distance us emotionally and psychologically from the truth of our experience. We also learn to justify eating animals. And the way we learn to justify eating animals is by learning to believe that the myths of eating animals are the facts of eating animals. And there's a vast mythology surrounding eating animals, but all of these myths fall under what I refer to as the three ends of justification, that eating animals is normal, natural, and necessary. You know, not surprisingly, these same arguments have been used to justify violent practices throughout human history, from male dominance to heterosexual supremacy. And carnism exists in meat-eating cultures around the world. So, you know, people might be thinking, well, you know, but in some places they eat dogs, and that's absolutely true. But our experience of eating animals remains remarkably consistent. In meat-eating cultures around the world, people learn to classify a small handful of animals as edible, and all the rest they classify as inedible and often disgusting and offensive to consume. So even though the type of species consumed changes from culture to culture, members of all cultures tend to see their own choices as rational and the choices of other cultures as strange and disgusting and even offensive.
So now tell us about the lives of farmed animals. Give us a snapshot of their brief and unhappy lives in our food system.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're talking about a staggering number of individuals who are slaughtered. As I said, in one day, more farmed animals are killed globally than the total number of people killed in all wars throughout history. You can just imagine the speed at which these individuals have to be killed is really unprecedented when it comes to killing animals. The industrialization of animal agriculture has made it such that it's impossible to actually kill animals in any way other than a way that is what most people would consider quite brutal. So a number of animals are not, in fact, stunned before they're slaughtered. They go to, you know, they're strung up and they may be dunked in boiling water, scalding water while still alive. I really want to be careful with how much I share because I don't want to traumatize listeners who are not ready for this information. So I'll keep this, somewhat limited. Suffice it to say that animals are farmed animals are often, in fact, pretty much always dehorned, debeaked. They have their horns, their beaks, their tails cut off without anesthesia, castrated without anesthesia. For most people, the suffering endured by farmed animals is such that it's so extensive that even if it were reduced by 90%, it would still be 10% too much for them to get behind and support. But the good news is that there is an alternative to carnism. I think it's important to, you know, not think of the solution to carnism as being all or nothing. It's not that, you know, either you stop eating animals altogether and you're part of the solution, or you keep eating animals and you're part of the problem, but that you really see carnism and veganism or plant-based eating on a spectrum. And where you fall on that spectrum is in some ways less important than where you're headed. So I always encourage people to really just try to, you know, reduce the amount of carnistic foods in their diet Crowding them out, as my colleague and friend Kathy Freston says, rather than cutting them out, adding more plants into your diet so there's less room for the animal-based foods, and try to be as vegan as possible at each meal, and really ask yourself how you can be an ally in the transformation of carnism, to use your influence in whatever way you can to raise awareness and help move society, move the world toward transformation. Maybe that means, you know, being a radio host and interviewing people who are talking about this issue to raise awareness. Or if you're a journalist, writing about the issue, or if you're a philanthropist, donating to organizations that are working toward the transformation of carnism.
Melanie Joy, you know, I eat mostly plants, but I do eat some meat, and I'm careful to buy, you know, the grass-fed, humanely raised, sometimes even, you know, local farms where I know how the animals are treated. I know that they're out on the pasture. I know the chickens are running around because I see them when I go by them. You say in this book that humane meat production is an oxymoron. Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to say that people who are doing like what you're doing, which is voting with their dollar, you know, I think this is an important step that people take, that they're actually making a statement and saying, I want to try to reduce the support that I give to industries that I don't believe in. And I think, you know, what's happened is that people have in recent years, thanks to the advent of the internet, among other things, become increasingly aware, as I said, of this problem. And at least, you know, most people are now aware of at least the most egregious practices of carnistic industry or animal agriculture. The problem is that animal agriculture or agribusinesses have responded by providing people with the idea that eating animals who are raised in a certain way is quote unquote cruelty free. And that simply, it's not the case. While it is true that in some ways these animals do have better lives, I mean, there's no disputing that, it's also true that there is a level of cruelty inherent in the production of so-called humane products that is far, far more what most people would be comfortable with. The only way to really understand this, you know, or to start to understand this is to kind of step outside of the carnistic box. So, you know, most of us would consider it cruel to slaughter a happy, healthy golden retriever just because people like the way her legs taste. And yet when the exact same thing is done to individuals of other species, we're asked to consider that humane. I mean, it really is a contradiction in terms when you think humane meat is really a contradiction in terms when you think of it this way. You know, and this dog, or these individuals, I should say, had lives that they wanted to continue living and perhaps have left others behind who are now grieving their death. And all of these animals essentially end up at the very same slaughterhouses. And many of the practices that I described earlier, which is, you know, debeaking, cutting beaks off without anesthesia and castration without anesthesia and so on, are still implemented in so-called humane farms.
But then there's a big question that I didn't see you answer in this book, although I think you answered almost every other objection by those who are what would you call people who believe in carnism? Carnists?
I think most people don't actually believe in carnism, but many people participate in carnism because that's what we've been socialized to do. So, I mean, they're just not vegan.
Okay, so let's say carnists, the objections of carnists, but the one big question that I always have when I hear this is what would happen to these animals if we didn't eat them? Because nobody's going to raise them if they can't raise them for food, and I doubt that there are going to be enough domestic animal sanctuaries, non-pet domestic animal sanctuaries that would keep their population alive. And, you know, we do know and we can see that wild pigs who often, I lived for a while in southern France and there were escaped pigs who became wild and who absolutely, you know, were destroying the ecology of the region because there was no check on them. So how do you address the problem of what's going to happen to these animals if we don't eat them?
I mean, so when we think about the, you know, the trillions of animals that make up the global farmed animal population, you know, we wouldn't be breeding these animals in the first place. So we wouldn't really need to be worried about what we do with them. Phasing out carnism, phasing out carnistic industry is not something that will ever happen overnight. It's going to happen over, and it is, you know, happening over a very, very long period of time. And with this transition, you know, we will inevitably and automatically not be creating animals that we will then not have to worry about finding a home or a placement for.
Yeah, but it, basically you're saying cows and other animals of this kind would go extinct.
I mean, I don't have the answer to that because I think we have to take the first step before we can take the next step. And we don't know what we're going to be looking at in the next, you know, 50, 100 or 150 years and what alternatives and options we're going to have. What I can say is that creating somebody for the sole purpose of dismembering and consuming them is probably a practice that the vast majority of people really don't ethically support. And so as we start phasing out this practice, we can start engaging in conversations about what might be an alternative that is satisfactory and ethically in alignment with where most of us stand.
So Melanie Joy, in this book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, you also talk about the human toll of this meat industrial complex. I was shocked to read in your book that contaminated meat is the rule. 76% of ground turkey has E. coli, 63% of chicken, 47% of ground beef, and 38% of pork chops were contaminated. You know, basically, there's shit in our meat.
At the time of the writing of the edition, the new edition of the book, which is about a year ago, yes, those were the statistics. And it's not surprising when you think about, you know, an industry that is in the business of killing other beings and processing their bodies for food.
And also talk about the impact on the workers in the meat industry. I mean, we all know that they face the most horrific conditions with huge amounts of injuries. During COVID, they were deemed essential workers. Many, many workers in the meat industry died. But there's also a psychological toll about working with these animals. Talk about that.
I mean, most people, the vast majority of people who work in slaughterhouses and meat packing plants, you know, one of the most dangerous jobs that a person can have, you know, are not there because they choose to. They're there because they have to be there. And, you know, you already pointed out some of the problems inherent in these positions, but you can only imagine the psychological toll it takes for somebody to work in a highly dangerous, death-saturated environment, basically on the killing floor in a position of killing day in and day out. And, you know, some investigations have found that people who are in these conditions develop post-traumatic stress responses. They may develop addictions, you know, turn to alcohol and other devices as coping mechanisms. Carnism is a system of victimization. You know, it victimizes much more than just the animals. Carnism victimizes, as I pointed out earlier, the environment and public health and humans through public health problems that are created. And also, of course, those who work in meatpacking plants and slaughterhouses.
Yeah, I just have to tell our listeners about one quote in your book. One meatpacking worker said that pigs down on the kill floor have come up and nuzzled me like a puppy. 2 minutes later, I had to kill them, beat them to death with a pipe. I mean, that's just horrendous. And because this suffering is so extensive, the system also that promotes it is so entrenched. Are there ways in which a policy can address this issue? Because people can make individual decisions, but ultimately the big changes happen when governments get behind that, when companies get behind that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anybody who's interested in learning more about carnism and helping to raise awareness of carnism can visit us at carnism.org. My organization is Beyond Carnism. There are lots of resources there. You are right. Big change is going to happen on a big level. It's going to be institutional. It's going to be also on the level of policy. Policy makers are people. People working in government are people. And I really believe that as long as people remain unaware of carnism, until people become aware of carnism, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to have an objective conversation about the legitimacy of eating animals. We can't have an objective conversation about this issue as long as we're operating from within the very mindset, the very system that conditions us to believe that eating animals is legitimate. So I do believe that awareness raising is really critical among people, and this will help us shift policy. And as I said earlier, on an individual level, you can become a vegan ally, use your influence in whatever way you can to assist in the transformation of carnism.
Well, Melanie Joy, your book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, is a huge contributor to that. It's just come out in the 10th anniversary edition, and thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh my God, thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Melanie Joy is a psychologist specializing in relationships, communication, and social transformation. She's the award-winning author of 6 books. Find a link to download the first chapter of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.